Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century with a fast, easy, and completely online process. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When the Apple iPhone first burst onto the marketplace back in 2007, it was said again and again, this will change our lives. We did shows on it here at On Point. Well, it's been 9 years since, and yes, we have changed. Look around. People everywhere with heads bowed over phones in all kinds of tasks and interactions. And this journey is not over. This hour On Point, what's next for the smartphone? And the way we live, you can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Did you pay attention to yesterday's launch of the newest iPhone, iPhone 7? How important is your smartphone in your life now? Samsung, Apple, whatever it may be, how has it changed the way you live? What do you want next from your smartphone? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Smartphones in the news recently. Samsung had halted sales, announced a recall of all 2.5 million of its new Galaxy Note 7 smartphones because of a flaw in its batteries that has caused some of them to catch fire and explode. Worse, the FAA may ban them on airplanes. Here's an ABC News report from last week.
Multiple consumers have now complained of explosions of their Galaxy Note 7 devices. The news has wiped out about $7 billion of Samsung's stock value, and it comes at a time when we're about to hear about that new iPhone coming from Apple, so bad timing for them.
Ouch, that wasn't fun for Samsung, though they have many fans around the world. And yes, Apple was coming out with its own latest version, iPhone 7. Here was Apple CEO Tim Cook in San Francisco at yesterday's launch of the latest iPhone 7 devices and software, saying the iPhone has changed the way we live.
We are so excited about iPhone 7. It makes all the things you do every day so much better. The iPhone has transformed the way we do things every day, and in the process, it's become truly a cultural phenomenon.
Let's dive in. Look at smartphones, where they've come, where they're headed. Joining me now in the studio is Elizabeth Wojcicki. She's business editor at MIT Technology Review, former technology writer at Forbes, Business Week, Fast Company, Reuters, the author of The Smartphone, Anatomy of an Industry. Elizabeth, thank you very much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us from San Francisco is David Pierce. He's senior writer at Wired, former deputy editor at The Verge, former tech writer for The Washington Post and PC Magazine. You guys get around. David Pierce was at yesterday's big Apple launch in San Francisco. David, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So what we hear is no headphone jack. Beyond that, is there big evolution here? What are the steps forward in the iPhone 7?
I think there are a lot of small steps forward in the iPhone 7, I would say. I think the camera is what Apple really intends to be the big one, especially on the new larger iPhone 7 Plus, which actually has two cameras that let you do some interesting things with zoom and different ways that you can play with your photos. But really what you have here is a lot of small changes, which has been really Apple's MO for the last several years. It comes in a couple of new colors. It has a faster processor. It's more waterproof, which is a wonderful change. But in general, I think you look at the phone. I remember walking into the hands-on area. Apple always has this large room next to where they present where you can just play with the phones. And seeing the new phone, and it took me a full minute to realize that this phone sitting on the table in front of me was not somebody else's phone from last year, but was actually the new one.
It looks, in other words, it looks almost exactly like what we're all familiar with.
It does, yeah. There are a couple of very small changes. And again, there are these two new colors. There's jet black and black. One is glossy, sort of like a piano, and the other is matte and a little more subdued. But if you don't have those colors, you will almost certainly not have a chance of figuring out which phone is which,
Elizabeth,
at least at first glance.
Is this enough to get you excited about a new iPhone? The fact that we got some new colors that look like the, you know, black keys on a piano, maybe one of them, and that it's got better cameras, and we're going toward the wireless.
Well, I think, you know, in terms of the changes in the user experience, the things that users will notice and I guess appreciate, hopefully from Apple's point of view, are the operating system changes probably, which were not, you know, outlined yesterday because Apple does that at its other event, its developers conference. So things like opening up Siri and Maps to outside developers, you know, that has the potential to really change a lot of the apps that people use commonly. And I think, you know, even though those types of changes were not highlighted yesterday, that is probably what I would say are the changes that users can kind of expect to maybe be more excited about.
I want to stick with the phone for a second. I mean, David, go to the home button. It's got a different feeling to it. You're not going to feel it like press in when you put pressure on it. Now it's got a, what is this, haptic? It's just going to buzz or click under your finger. What's going on there?
That's right. So Apple likes to call it their Taptic Engine, which is sort of classic Apple rebranding of a fairly standard feature. And essentially what it is they've replaced the mechanical home button, which actually would move and click when you pressed it, with haptic feedback. So now it will buzz and vibrate when you press your finger down. It's a pressure-sensitive sensor. And the idea long-term is both that it's much more repairable, or I guess they'll have to do fewer repairs now because
the
home button is traditionally the most breakable thing on an iPhone. But also that now with this pressure sensitivity, there's all sorts of interesting things that Apple can start to do. They've started doing 3D touch last year where you can press harder on the screen to do new things. And I think there's real potential to do that and more with the home button.
What about the new cameras? You've got a new one on the 7, two new ones on the 7 Plus. What additional photographic capacity do they deliver?
Yeah, well, on the iPhone 7, it's really just that everything is better across the board. Apple has improved its algorithms for figuring out where your face is and exposing perfectly for it. It's improved the image signal processor and the processor. It can take more photos in worse lighting. It's sort of standard. It just gets better every year. On the bigger phone, the iPhone 7 Plus, Apple has added a second camera. And essentially, the way it works is that it's two different cameras at two different focal lengths. So one is zoomed in further than the other. And you can switch between the two with the press of a single button on the screen. So you have what amounts to 2x zoom just at the tap of a button. And Apple's also collecting data from both of those sensors all the time. So it can take better pictures and then stitch them together and find the best of each image to give you something that has less noise and better colors and just is a better image all overall.
Elizabeth, longer battery life, we're told here. Is that a general feature in new iterations from Android and the Apple side lately? Battery life is a big deal for everybody.
Right. I mean, I would say that that's certainly a goal for any smartphone maker. I think when... To the extent that consumers are ever asked what they want to see in their next smartphone, battery life is always high on the list. And in fact, that gets to one of the reasons, you know, Samsung got in this trouble with the Galaxy Note 7 is that it is a bigger battery than the previous version.
But bursting into flames, have they figured out what that's about? Or just exploding? I mean, why?
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I mean, I think we know that lithium-ion batteries, which are what are used in smartphones, are very volatile. I mean, that's sort of just true of the sort
These
of
are the
chemistry.
Same ones that have blown up in the what are the wheeled things that kids are zooming around?
The hoverboards.
The hoverboards, right.
And in laptops, you know, they're sort of in many gadgets.
And in Boeings.
Yeah.
Sadly.
Now, of course, we don't see all of those gadgets catching on fire. And what's interesting is I thought initially when I heard about this, I thought, oh, well, maybe this was sort of an unprecedentedly large battery, smartphone battery. But it actually is not. In fact, Samsung's Galaxy S7 Edge, which was released earlier this year, which is also a large smartphone, has an even larger battery. So it's kind of interesting to me that there must, you know, be something in the way it's put together internally.
And then, David Pierce, everybody's talking about no headphone jack. The earbuds with their cord, that was part of Apple's core marketing for the iPhone for a long time. You know, there's those silhouette photographs of young men and women with that cord looking so jazzy. Cord all gone now. Nowhere to plug it in.
Yeah, it's funny. You look back at those old iPod ads from like 10 years ago, and the most iconic thing was those white headphones. That was for years the thing that made you realize you saw that cable and you knew somebody was using an Apple product.
Right.
And it's odd to think that that's just gone now. So, but Apple, basically the way they talked about this yesterday, and they only hinted at it, but I think this is really important to them, is that they envision this sort of seamless wireless future where you are constantly connected to all of your devices and everything is right there in front of you and there are no worries about connections or cables or wires. And they have all these really, I think, sort of lovely ideas about how these things are supposed to work. And the way to get there, I think Apple deeply oversold their ambition by calling it courageous to get rid of the headphone jack. But I think at some point, they were simply going to have to. And the reality is a headphone jack is a fairly large component in a phone. Part of the reason the battery life is longer is because without a headphone jack, there's more room for battery in the phone now. And so you add that into the fact that it's easier to make it waterproof when there's no headphone jack, and the fact that Apple would really like to usher in this world where everyone wears Apple's white headphones on their ears, but wirelessly. And it, I think, sort of starts to make sense. I don't know if it's a good idea, but I kind of see why Apple did it.
And, Elizabeth, then using that iPhone with its wireless connections to what? To be the control center for other devices in your home or in the car around you? This becomes, starts as a telephone, becomes mobile computing, and then becomes a kind of a mobile control station?
Yeah, I think, it's been true for a while now, and I think it's still true that the smartphone is kind of, I don't know, however you define it, the hub around which your other gadgets, or the hub around which your other gadgets connect to, or sort of in the solar system, it's the sun around which these other gadgets kind of revolve. And I thought it was interesting that yesterday at the iPhone event, Tim Cook, I believe, took time to single out the sort of home automation feature of iOS now that had come, I guess, from the HomeKit technology.
Keep track of my heating and cooling at home, so, or my security system, that sort of thing?
Your appliances. So it's kind of the Internet of Things in your house, and your iPhone sort of being the remote control for all of those things. And I think he said that there will be 100 new sort of partners or products, rather, that would be hooked into this platform by the end of the year.
Is this going to stay in our hands, David? We'll dive on in here. But is a smartphone perpetually the thing that we stare down at in our hand? Or are there moves afoot to change the platform entirely?
I think that is the many, many billion-dollar question for a lot of people. I think that there's been this really interesting shift in the last few months and couple of years, really, where I think people are finally reaching a point where they don't want to stare at their phone all the time. And the thing that we do to get people away from staring at their phone all the time, whether it's make smartphones or make other devices, is going to be critical to what comes next.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what is next for smartphones and how mobile computing and communication has changed, is still changing, the way we live. Elizabeth Woyke is with us with the MIT Technology Review. David Pierce is here. He's senior writer at Wired, was in San Francisco for the rollout of the new iPhone 7 there yesterday. Of course, there are plenty of Android versions out there as well. Samsung, a big competitor in this space, too. Yesterday was Apple's day. Here's part of the video from the launch of the iPhone 7 in San Francisco yesterday about the engineering of the body of the new iPhone. Beautifully shot video, almost fetishizes the construction process itself. Sounds like they're describing how to make a perfect Belgian pastry.
This begins with rotational 3D polishing. A specialized compound flows over the intricate geometries of the housing, removing imperfections, establishing a seamlessness between materials, and producing a pristine, mirror-like surface.
Fetishizing, exactly the word there, maybe. Almost need an adult content warning in advance of describing the manufacturer. The most controversial feature in the new iPhone is what isn't there. No more jack to plug in a headphone. At the Apple event yesterday in San Francisco, Johnny Ive, chief design officer, introduced its new AirPods, wireless earbuds, in this video.
We believe in a wireless future, a future where all of your devices intuitively connect. This belief drove the design of our new wireless AirPods. They have been made possible with the development of the new Apple Design W1 chip. It is the first of its kind to produce intelligent, high-efficiency playback while delivering a consistent and reliable connection.
Okay, can all that love become a parody of itself? Stephen Colbert thinks so. On The Late Show last night, he parodied Tim Cook's launch of the new iPhone 7. Dressed in Tim Cookian gray-blue shirt, he channels the iPhone Zen.
We believe the iPhone 7 is the most exciting iPhone yet. But we thought, if less is more, how much more could we less? That fragile glass front? Gone. And with no front, do you really need a back?
No front, no back. Where do smartphones go? You can join us. Are you watching the latest product releases? What do you want? What are you waiting for? Are you freaking out that Apple is ditching the headphone jack? And where do you see smartphones going? What's the frontier, the future? Will they finally get out of our hands, into our clothes, our skin, our brains? We've got callers, Elizabeth and David, who are much more practically oriented. Kenny in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Kenny, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I switched from Android to Apple 1 month ago, and I have with me an iPhone 6S, and I was watching the launch last night.
Yeah.
Everything was good. I loved the upgrade. However, when I got to the earbuds, that kind of ticked me off, because although the cords get tangled up and they do get misplaced very often, at the end of the day, they keep the pods together. And so my question is, doesn't that defeat the whole purpose? Because the earbuds are expensive, $159. I mean, and if they are detached, they are going to get lost quite often.
Yeah, it's a great question, Kenny. I mean, I don't know how many hours I've spent over the years untangling my earbud cords there. But David Pierce, can you describe these new ear, what are they calling them?
They're called AirPods.
AirPods.
And essentially, they are... So everyone who's bought an iPhone for years has gotten what are called EarPods in the box. Mm-hmm. And it's basically, it looks very much like Apple just cut the cable off right at the end. And we're like, oh, we've done it. It's perfect.
But there's a little white extension that sticks out from your ear, right? Something there?
Yes. So it's a little earbud that sticks in your ear, and then a very small sort of matchstick length rail that comes out of the ear, and at the mm-hmm. bottom of it on each side is a microphone, and it's where the battery goes, and the chip is in there. And so there are I think practical reasons for it, but the upshot is that you look sort of silly, like something is just pouring out of your ears.
You use two of them, not just one, like some of the Bluetooth connections out there now.
That's right. They're meant very much to be used like headphones. You can use one, but the way that Apple has set it up is actually if you're wearing both and you take one or both out of your ears, your music will stop playing. So it's clear that the intention there is that you will wear both all
wow.
the time.
You will wear both if you want music, and you will have stereo music. What about the cost of these and the ergonomics, Elizabeth? They're going to be dropping out as we do our, bicycling and jogging and all the rest?
So I have to say, when I watched the event online, my first thought was, having lived in New York City for many years, I was thinking of all the people who sort of lean over the train tracks looking for the train, the subway to approach, and, you know, it just kind of dropping out of your ear, and the ramifications of that.
Yes.
Although I did read, and I don't know, David, if you had hands-on time with it, I did read a blog post yesterday from someone who did try them on and said they were actually more secure than she would have guessed, and that surprised me, because those the EarPods, the free headphones Apple has been giving out for years, I think are notoriously ill-fitting. They certainly were for my ears. Mm-hmm. But apparently, even though these look so similar, I guess they are better fitting. Perhaps, you know, I'm sure that was all part of the design and technology.
David, are you going to make a guarantee that when we go skydiving, they'll stay in our ears?
I'm shaking my head vigorously into the microphone. Yeah. No, I did have sort of the same experience where with the EarPods, they constantly fall out of my ears. And the AirPods were, at least in the few minutes I got to try them, a little more secure. And I'm always wary of drawing too many conclusions from sort of 5 minutes in a yep. crowded room right after the event. But it is a little bit better, I hope. But I'm still deeply, deeply worried about the fact that there are now more things to lose and keep track of and make sure they go back into their case, or else everything will fall. I'm just going to lose them in my bag. Like, they will just disappear into my bag and be gone forever. And that's really going
to
be my problem.
And to charge, having another thing to charge. I don't think anyone's looking for another thing to charge.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's for sure. No. What about, compare this to the latest Samsung offering or the Android platform competitors that are out there, Elizabeth?
The
iPhone 7, no, the overall, yeah. So the iPhone 7, where Apple's going, where its competitors are going. Who does somebody own the leading edge now? Is everybody neck and neck? Is it a different experience if you're on one or the other in some fundamental
right.
way?
So what's always interesting to me is, you know, Apple will sort of seemingly debut a new feature in the iPhone that people think Apple's the first to do. And so actually we have seen Lenovo, for example, with its Motorola, or Moto, actually, it calls it now, had taken out the headphone jack already a few months ago in a phone that obviously did not get as much attention. In terms of dual cameras, we've also seen that on a few Android models. Again, I think the implementation, especially of the cameras, was very different. So I mean, it's not going to have the same sort of optical zoom and bokeh background effects as this iPhone 7 will. But so these are not sort of completely unprecedented feature changes. However, in terms of, innovation, I think an interesting trend in smartphones that Apple has not touched, perhaps wisely, is this idea of sort of modular or kind of modules, I guess, that you add on to your phone. And that is something that a couple Android phone makers have experimented with mixed results.
More computing power, with more features?
Yeah, so it's sort of, there's different, so Lenovo has done this again with Moto, I think. There are others, and so there are sort of modules, just like maybe you would put a battery pack or like a case on your phone that already has battery pack.
Yep.
This would actually be sort of, you'd be actually taking perhaps the bottom part of your smartphone off and then sort of sliding the battery actually into the smartphone. And then there are other ones, I think there's ones, you know, that are kind of like a speaker for your phone. There's one that is related to camera functionality. So there's sort of these additional functions that you kind of modularly, like Lego-like almost.
David, are they on the same evolutionary path here? Do people need to make a fundamental decision about, you know, are you an Apple person or an Android person in terms of the way you use a phone? Is there an advantage to going down one path or the other?
Well, I think if you're in a position of just wanting to buy a phone and never think about it again, that it's just sort of, it's like buying clothes and it just exists in your life and you know what to do with it, Apple is still probably the way to go. It's still the sort of simplest onboarding process. It's just the phone most people understand. But I think what's really interesting, especially in the Android ecosystem, is that there's real experimentation starting to happen again. I think for a long time there was this idea that there was kind of a platonic ideal of a smartphone that everyone was going towards, and it was going to be super thin and amazing in every facet, and they kind of had this idea of what it was going to be. And we reached a point where if that is true, Apple kind of already made that, which is why Apple is making all of the money in smartphones. And so now there's this thing happening with all these other manufacturers where they're swinging sort of in other directions, trying to figure out what else might work, whether it's modularity or working on pen input or going, you know, even above and beyond with camera features. So there's a really interesting thing happening in the Android ecosystem where everybody is kind of rethinking the fundamental idea of what a smartphone is even supposed to be and do.
A couple of calls, then I want to go to Lawrence Scott in London, who's thinking about the four-dimensional human, how we are wrapping our lives around these devices. But first, Portland, Maine, Garrett. Garrett, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. Hey, you mentioned, what were we looking for in future iPhones or future smartphones? And one of my big concerns is a lot of texting and driving going on. I see it
all over the place.
Every intersection.
Yeah. Yep.
Why can't we have a simple switch like we have on airplanes where we just flip the switch and it sends a message to the people texting to us that we can respond at a future time? Maybe the same with like voicemail, just in an effort to, help, create a higher level of safety for smartphones.
But who's going to flip the switch, Garrett? Everybody seems to want to be texting at the stoplight.
I understand. That's so true. I know. And I'm guilty of it, too. And I get angry when I see people texting, and I'm a hypocrite for that. But
you can send them an angry text while you're going along. But what about a driving mode, Elizabeth? Have you heard of that out there?
So the closest thing I can think of, I don't think there is a driving mode, which is interesting because we certainly see smartphone makers doing a lot of sort of child protection.
Yeah.
Type measures, but not so much, I guess, for the driver. But, we definitely, there have been for a couple of years those kind of canned messages that you can send. So if you're in a meeting and
call comes
in. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But you're still obviously looking at your phone and touching it. So that's not super helpful in this scenario.
One more here. Fort Collins, Colorado. Morgan. Morgan, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to bring up the interesting fact that there's been kind of a very large revolution in small business owners using the headphone jacks for card swiping.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that they're removing that from their new system.
Yeah, the plugging that swiper into the end of the phone. What does that mean for companies who depend on that? David, do you follow that at all? I see that all over the place, with, as Morgan says, out of Colorado, with small businesses.
Yeah, I think what happens now with companies like Square and some of its many competitors is going to be fascinating. I suspect many of those companies are already coming out with Lightning-based or USB-based products, but it sort of speaks to what's complicated about getting rid of the headphone jack in general, which is that it was the one truly universal thing. That's why these companies like Square got into using the headphone jack in the first place, despite the fact that it's not great technology. It's just everywhere. And I can hand you one and it will definitely work. And I think now we're going to end up in this really interesting sort of platform war where if I'm Square, I'm going to have to make four or five of these things.
That could get crazy in a hurry. They won't want people to give up their old phones for a long time. David Pearce in San Francisco at Wired, please stand by there. And Elizabeth Wojcie with me here from MIT Technology Review in Boston. I want to go to London right now. And Lawrence Scott is author of the new book, The Four-Dimensional Human: Ways of Being in the Digital World. Lawrence Scott, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. You're paying a lot of attention to how all this connectedness that our smartphones have brought to us is actually changing the way we live, the way we behave, the way we interact. What do you see?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think they've just totally revolutionized and changed social life as we know it from before they were around. I mean, I remember getting scolded in about 2003 for texting under the table on my crappy cell phone of the time, 2003, that could do nothing. But I remember the people I were with, they were trying to cheers their glasses, and when the glass turned to me, I was texting under the table. and I got, it was like the biggest social faux pas I could make, like looks of horror in their eyes. And now this is a norm.
Yeah.
Of social life, that we sort of shimmer in and out of each other's presences, that the four walls that we're in a bar or wherever, that isn't the story when it comes to the possibilities of social life. We could be off on Tinder, we could be out anywhere, we could be texting someone in another country.
We shimmer in and out of one another's presences. This word, this verb you use quite advisedly, that there's something, it's made us shimmeringly present remotely to others, but also even when we're physically present, we're not quite fully present.
No, and people, I think, have picked up on this, and there's all sorts of etiquette that is going to really, I think, I talk about all the advances on your show today about where the smartphone is going next. I think sort of social etiquette will actually have to be upgraded various notches, and we see examples of this, like those games where if you're at dinner with people, you put your phones in the middle, and if anyone reaches for the phone, they pay the check or the bill. All sorts of things like that, and I think in the last 5 years, we've seen the wonder going out of, I think, smartphone usage as they've become more normalized, and people actually saying, do you really want to use that in front of me when I could be talking to you?
Well, I wonder. I understand the etiquette problem there. On the other hand, the magnetism of these things is so obviously apparent.
Yeah.
Could it be that this idea of extending our communications powers, and for that matter, our what feels like our brain power through the computer and these smartphones, is just irresistible, that we will come to understand each other as shimmering presences? That's just the way it will be. We're sort of there and sort of not.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really generous, optimistic outlook, I think. I hope it comes to that. I mean, I think one of the things is that the weird thing about the public-private thing and understanding one another is that on the one hand, say, on social media, which a lot of we're checking on our smartphones all the time, that sort of, in a way, cracked private life open. Like now people will update when they're going into surgery. They're like just checked into some hospital and you see them in the hospital bed. Yeah. You're like, oh, my God. On the other hand, public space has been strangely privatized. So I was on the tube coming on the subway today coming into work, and someone was watching a TV program next to me with big headphones on a smartphone. And I was thinking, in the old days, you know, those books where strangers meet on a train and something else happens, like a plot device, all of that, those random encounters are probably migrated online and aren't happening in the strangely emptied out public space. So public and private are totally sort of in a Alice in Wonderland way, sort of inverted. In terms of knowing one another better, as you asked, I mean, I notice my students a lot of the time, they'll be not talking to each other, but texting on their smartphones or messaging, WhatsApp and stuff. And I just think, what is the compulsion for the abstract sociability, the remote sociability, over the one that's right in front of us?
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. With Rocket Mortgage, you can get approved for a mortgage in minutes using a phone or tablet. This completely online process uses cutting-edge technology to make getting a mortgage more convenient than ever before. Now you can safely share bank statements and pay stubs with the touch of a button without the frustration of digging through stacks of financial documents. Info at quickenloans.com/onpoint, equal housing lender. Licensed in all 50 states, NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what's next for smartphones and how mobile computing and communication has changed, is still changing, the way we live. You can join us this hour. Are you addicted to that smartphone? Has it changed your life already? What's the next change you foresee? And has it changed you directly, the way you move, the way you interact with people, the way you think, the way you show affection? Has it changed? Has your smartphone changed? Think about it. Has it changed the way you are in the world? We've got David Pierce in San Francisco. He was at the Apple rollout yesterday. Of course, Samsung has a new Galaxy Note 7 out there as well. A couple of issues with that, but they're pushing ahead. Elizabeth Wojcicki is with us from MIT Technology Review. And from London, England, Lawrence Scott is here. His new book is The Four-Dimensional Human: Ways of Being in the Digital World. Britain's Sunday Times called it the Thought Book of the Year, finalist for the Samuel Johnson Prize. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Let's go to our listeners, Eddie in New Orleans, in Louisiana. Eddie, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing? Yes.
Okay.
Awesome. Hey, this is a very great subject. I just want to express how that the smartphone, speaking for myself first, I would say it has changed me as far as even how I communicate, show affection, as you mentioned earlier. But I just want to say that even though we're in a day of what I would call the information age, you know, due to how our technology is steadily advancing and how quick it is, I feel like the changes that our technology, I mean, the effects that our technology has on us shouldn't control us. Because even though it allows for much convenience in our daily living, there should be a type of initiative, a manual control that we have, a manual connection with life that we should maintain. Even though technology makes things easier, you know, it feels good to be able to check the weather, as we all know. It feels good to, you know, be able to order a pizza without having to leave home or shop. But at the same time, we have to realize that our technological devices of this day and time are not really as safe as they're marketed to be, or if not mentioned, you know. So we have to realize that there are some hazards that our technological devices, mainly our smartphones, and computers and everything like that. Anything that has an IP address, we have to remember, though we depend on these devices, they still can disrupt or present a type of hazard if it chooses to. They have a sense of their own intellect. You know, that's why they're called the smart phone. You know,
I don't know about a sense of their intellect, but, I mean, there's hazards. I've seen people just walking across the road with their head down in their phone, so the hazard can present itself pretty quickly. Eddie, I appreciate your call. Lawrence in London, let me bring this to you. Here's another listener, writes to us, says, so-called smartphones are not making people smarter. They're causing people to be in their own micro-bubbles, oblivious to everything and everyone around them, to the point where situational awareness is at an all-time low. Relying on technology at the sacrifice of losing real knowledge is not ultimately in the best interest of humanity. Lawrence Scott in London, is that Luddite or just right?
Well, I think there's sort of a point to that, and any new technology has done that. Even Nicholas Carr argues brilliantly in his book The Shallows about how even the first maps were a way of removing us from the physical world. So the way you would once take a journey thinking that's the river, that's the specific tree, the abstract quality of a map allows you to think, just not have to know those sort of specific physical details of orientation. So we're always sort of, any new technology has this question of what is being numbed by our interaction with it. I mean, I think there's all these studies, and it seems patently obvious. There's one out in the UK last year that people check their smartphones 85 times a day. I think that it's probably higher, and probably in the hundreds, to be honest, between 1 and 200 times. And it just seems obvious that this is, there's something compulsive about it. And I think it'd be crazy to object to the fact that we have an app that allows us to do all these very practical things. I don't think that's what people are checking. I think it's when somehow the self or the ego gets all whirled up in this world that that's where the compulsion comes from, waiting to hear from someone, wondering if something that you've posted has received the accolades you're hoping for.
Yes.
You know, I just don't think people have got, the compulsion doesn't come from the practicality. It comes from us and our interactions with it.
David Pierce, in San Francisco, it's patently obvious that there's a compulsive kind of usage that goes on. I don't claim to be independent from it myself sometimes, but I assume the manufacturers of these are very aware of that. Do you see any limit to their ambition in sort of riding the technology and that compulsive use to deeper and deeper engagement with these smartphones, David?
Well, I think left to their own devices, no. I think they would happily continue to make phones that just draw you in further and further. But what I'm starting to see everywhere, but also in Silicon Valley, which is surprising here, is that people are starting to will themselves away from these devices. Mm. And I was speaking to someone the other day who makes a fitness tracker, and they're really concerned about the idea of these digital detoxes that are becoming increasingly popular, where people take a day or a weekend or a week and forcibly remove themselves from all technology.
They're concerned they're saying, about because it's a market loss, you mean?
Right. They're saying, how do we make a device that's on you all the time that is technology but doesn't feel like technology? And I think that's the big question that everyone is starting to answer, is once we get past this sort of gee whiz phase of technology where everything is cool just because it does something new and shiny and fast, and it gets to the fact where these things are fundamentally just part of our lives. And I think we're there, but we're only starting to really sort of sit in that moment and try to figure out what it is that comes after that and how these devices are actually supposed to be part of our lives without totally subsuming them, because people will run away from that. And I think even as a manufacturer, that's going
to
be scary.
Well, that gets to the evolutionary path. Where does that point? Did they give you the secret ingredient answer to that question of how to make it, you know, technology that doesn't feel like technology? That sounds like the evolutionary path of the smartphone, very, very likely.
I think no one really knows, to be honest. I think one thing we're seeing a lot of here is the idea that your smartphone, and Elizabeth, you brought this up earlier, that your smartphone becomes sort of a hub for other devices. And whether it's a watch, which allows you to do a lot of the same things more quickly, or things like Siri, where you can just talk to your phone and not be distracted by these shiny icons and unread badges. I think these are small steps in this direction where the reality is people are going to want to continue to do things efficiently. Like the idea of going back to calling a cab is going to quickly feel anachronistic to people who can just use Uber.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the question becomes, how do I give people Uber but make it feel better than having to unlock your phone and see all your unread emails and all the stuff that's going on Facebook and all these things? So I think these smaller, more focused devices are going to become much more prevalent. That seems to be the first answer a lot of these companies have.
What might that look like, Elizabeth? If we want the capacity, but maybe not in the traditional smartphone package, where does it go?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, they're one thing that Samsung is rumored to be bringing to market next year is a sort of a foldable or roll-up smartphone. I guess people have compared it to like a makeup compact that kind of closes in half. So, you know, is that
new or old? It sounds like like a cell phone from 20 years ago.
Well, I think the sort of eventual goal there is that if you can get a rollable smartphone, then you get sort of the larger screen real estate without having a bulky thing to carry.
Mm-hmm. Only when you need it.
Carry around. So there's an interesting question, you know, if that's sort of one of the few avenues forward in terms of a different form factor, because it is very difficult to take smartphones to a different form factor. I mean, they're already sort of very tightly packed with components as it is. You know, is that something like a foldable or rollable smartphone any more immersive or less immersive? And it will be interesting to see, because another thing that smartphone makers are definitely diving into, especially Google, is bringing augmented reality and virtual reality to smartphones, which if we talk about, you know, perhaps spending too much time on our smartphones and being kind of divorced from reality and in a bubble, I would think that having your phone sort of in a headset in front of your eyes with these AR or VR games and apps would probably exacerbate that to some extent.
Talk about removing from the world. Catherine in Davie, Florida. Catherine, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My name is Catherine. As you know, I'm an international student. And as a past teenager, I feel the pressure from all my friends, my family, to always be in social media, have my phone all the time with me. And that's something that really worries me, because I need to do this to be able to be in contact with other people.
Oh, you'd rather just look around and not have to do it via the phone all the time. I guess...
Yes, exactly. If I don't put my pictures in Instagram or Facebook, my life, it's as if your life didn't happen if you don't put it online.
Yeah, yeah. No, there's tremendous leverage there, kind of pressure to be there or be invisible. Catherine, I appreciate your call. One more, Vikas in Madison, Wisconsin. Vikas, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in healthcare technology, and I'm a big fan of Apple and the kind of things that smartphones have done for us.
Yeah.
But just to echo that point that you were just making about how it can divorce us from reality. So this Labor Day weekend, my girlfriend and I were up north in Door County, beautiful Door County.
Oh yeah, beautiful.
She's got a 9-year-old boy. I've got an 8-year-old girl, and we actually saw during that trip our kids kind of shimmer in and out of our experience. You know, it was so funny. We were kind of driving up towards Sister Bay, and a beautiful body of lake was coming up on our left. And my daughter says, "Dad, there is water. Pokemon Go shows there is water, because their heads were buried in Pokemon Go."
Pokemon Go alerted them that there was water, not the water itself.
Yeah, and she asked me, "How do you know?" I said, "Well, I can see out of the window. Just lift up your head and you can see water. You don't need to worry in Pokemon Go." So that experience just kind of worries me, kind of how it divorces us from reality and just the experience around us.
Yeah, shimmering, even with one's own children shimmering in and out of their lives. Because thanks for your call. Lauren Scott in London, there you go with your shimmering relationship. Yeah. It's a beautiful Door County in Wisconsin, absolutely beautiful territory, and the children experiencing it through Pokemon Go on their handset there, their smartphone.
That is almost just the perfect allegory, isn't it? It's almost beyond fable. You know, you could just write that story, and that would sort of be a cautionary tale for the times. I mean, one of the things I think is interesting about you saying how the trajectory going forward and how we become more embroiled with these devices and they become more seamless. I think I was reading somewhere about the iOS 10 talking about how you sort of outsource your own discipline to it. The idea that it gets to know your habits of when you want to go to bed, when you want to get up, and then it will become this strange disciplinarian who will encourage you when it's time to get up and when not. And so a lot of the things we're seeing about these technologies is that people say we need to sort of wean off them in some way, or some people would argue that, and yet we actually turn to them to help us wean off. You know, all the discipline software on the internet, if you want to get off Facebook, you load up this software that allows you to stay off Facebook for a while. So it's a brilliant sort of image of how we are getting quite drawn in, to the point of view that, to the extent that our virtues themselves of willpower are actually being recoded and
shimmering willpower right there, if we have it at all. We're talking about what's next for smartphones. Norfolk, Virginia, Joshua's calling. Hi, Josh, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
The point I wanted to make is, to answer your question, these pocket screens, as I like to refer to them, they're certainly very addicting. And definitely every day there doesn't go a moment where I kind of lose focus, because I just feel so impulsed to pull my phone out and just kind of check most of what I normally check. But I'm 26 years old, and there was certainly life before all the smartphones, and I definitely can say people my age and maybe a little older have a certain appreciation for life before we had all these devices. But I'm a little scared for kids who are growing up in today's age, where they're being handed iPads and phones at a very young age. It kind of makes me wonder what parents are thinking in terms of how they influence their kids with giving these screens to them. So I just wanted to hear what your panelists had to say about that.
I appreciate your call, Joshua. Let me get one more, and I'll take it to the panel. Thank you very much. Nick in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin. Nick, you're on.
Hey, fellas. I see smartphones. The iPhone's only been out since, 2007, and 10 years may seem like a pretty long time, but it's not really. And I see smartphones as just a stepping stone, a transition to something else, and obviously we don't know what else that will be, but they're really kind of clumsy and incredible technology, but it's only a stepping stone, and obviously we don't know what will be what they're going to transition to. But I see it just as a phase.
Yeah.
And we're going to come to something else in the not-too-distant future.
I mean, digital tech always seems to work that way. Elizabeth, if it's a stepping stone. Where do we go?
So, Sergey Brin, the Google co-founder, had talked about Google Glass as being the next step, you know, the next evolution beyond smartphones. And he had made the point, which, you know, I think resonated with many people. You feel sort of stupid often, you know, standing on a corner poking your finger at this, you know, slab of glass.
And yet I see a lot more slabs of glass than Google glasses around these days.
Right, exactly. Now, unfortunately, I mean, for that particular scenario, Google Glass, you know, did not turn out to be the solution.
Mm-hmm.
So the question, I guess, is, you know, can there be something that is worn on the face that is not, you know, sort of A, ridiculous looking, and B, mm-hmm. distracting, and C, creeps out other people, because certainly all of those things were issues with something like Google Glass. And that was actually a very lightweight type of, you know, head-worn computer.
Yeah, yeah. Lawrence, what do you think? Is it inevitable, shimmer or not, that, you know, humans want computing capacity? We value intelligence. We value knowing things. With a mobile computing in your hand, you can know just about anything.
Yeah, and that's why when people, you know, it's sort of, it is silly to argue that this, you know, it's not, it's making us so smart, so much smarter in so many ways, and we have to sort of think specifically about the various applications, because as you've been talking about all this hour, a smartphone is so many things, and to me, I think it's the jumble of them. This idea that we might actually have devices that are more segregated will probably be a more long-term tolerable way of handling this sort of technology, so that we don't get bound up in the libidinous aspects. That's what I think about it. I think there's a quite a high libido aspect with these technologies, and they sort of mimic round the clock that sort of erotic suspense of waiting by the phone. You know, that 80s cliche of I was waiting by the phone for someone to call who you were sexually interested in. I think there's something of that urgency, although it's nowhere near as fun, is sort of coded into the very ways in which we're able to check round the clock, has something happened? And it sort of gets us up to this state that is sort of agitated without even having any, you know, erotic payoff.
Kind of an amazing thought right there. We're out of time, but Lawrence Scott, author of The Four-Dimensional Human, takes us all the way to the libido. Hard to take that out of the equation. David Pierce at Wired, Elizabeth Wojcie with MIT Technology Review. Our great thanks to each of you for being with us this hour. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.